It's something watching you.
Well, if it's anything on your end, imagine over here. Scratch that. The last thing you want to hear is someone going off on your looks.
Don't be crazy. Tell me every detail.
Okay. Okay, I will.
Uh-huh.
They should name a gender after you. Looking at you doesn't do it. Staring is the only way that makes any sense. And trying not to blink so you don't miss anything and all of that. And you're you. I mean, look, forgive me. It's just you are drop-dead crazy gorgeous. So much so that I'm actually considering looking at you again before we finish up here.
Soon, please.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm your host and curator, Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator in this journey into the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler, Sejan Serwick. Sejan, how are you this evening?
I'm good, Devin. Thank you. Thank you for having me here for this. This is going to be a night to remember, I think, for us to really kind of dive into just one of the meatiest meals that we have served up, I think, so far this series.
I couldn't have said it better myself, and yet there is part of me that feels this might be the shortest episode ever of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. But
I disagree, man.
This is not the show where we make half-ass promises and fail to follow through on them. That's the Slay Report. This is the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the second episode of Season 3, where our theme is villains. Adam Sandler as the villain. Womp, womp, womp. And the film that we're looking at as number two is the James L. Brooks written and directed Spanglish.
Yeah, so Dev, I gotta ask, Tiger on the Table time, like, let's see how the sausage is made. You were the one that, like, recommended this movie, and I don't know how to... This season was built around this movie, like in a lot of ways. Like, when we initially were like, what should we do in the third season? Well, at some point, we got to talk about Spanglish. Yeah, and, like, Devin got that worm in his ear and was like, we're doing it. So here we are, and I'm curious where this falls for you. And part of this is me asking a question I already know the answer to, but part of it is a genuine question. Like, talk to me about how this movie's the villains.
Well, it's weird, right? Because the villain of it all and what this whole season is about is not necessarily movies where Adam Sandler portrays a villain. In fact, I think there might only really be one or two of those, and we'll get to them later on in this season. But the fact that he's a villain with Spanglish, and the whole reason why I built this season around it, is if I was talking to people about the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, or Adam Sandler in general, came up as a subject of conversation.
Yeah, long before the show was even conceived. Yeah. Like, I know where you're going with this, and yeah, this is, yeah.
Invariably, the film that would get brought up as the evidence pinnacle of Adam Sandler fucking sucks, I hate Adam Sandler, was Spanglish. Spanglish was this movie, and it really makes a lot of sense when you consider our generation, and specifically people born between 1986 and 1988.
I mean, I've got a theory that this movie just came 15 years too soon, because I like, we'll talk more about that when we get into it, but the idea being, like, it's not just that it's people of our generation, it's also that this movie came out at a time where it didn't lead the charge is not the right term, but it is one of the first through the door of this style of filmmaking that you see the ball get picked up and ran with in a lot of ways. And I'd be very interested to very soon do Funny People with you after this movie, because I feel like a lot of the artistic muscles that are being flexed by everybody in this film are the same ones that are asked of everybody involved in something like a Funny People. The other one that came up a lot for me was This Is 40. A lot of Judd Apatow. We'll talk about that too. I mean, you know, James L. Brooks basically was probably a mentor, like a
proto Apatow in a lot of ways.
Like, well, no kidding. In the room, mentor with Apatow on things like The Critic and The Simpsons and stuff. But yeah. So, but that idea being like this style of film, I think very much came into fashion 10 years after this movie was made, and this movie feels like it needed a little bit more time, even more than that, to kind of stew. But if this movie came out today, people would be just fucking gobbling it up, you know, especially after something like an Uncut Gems, right?
We'll
get deeper into the bits and bobs of this, but this is the show with a schedule, so let's stick to it.
This is the show with a schedule. So before we go too deep into it, let's just remind everybody what we're here to do. Hubie Halloween came out in 2020, and everybody said, oh my god, what if there's a shared universe of Adam Sandler films? And Sijin and I, we do another podcast, The Say Report, that's one about everything. We were kind of pushed forward by all of our friends and relations to be the two guys who defined the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. You get asked enough times to do something, and you're stuck inside because of, you know, unprecedented times in a pandemic. You figure, yeah, let's go for it, right? What else are we doing?
Yeah, and as a man in this world, you're obligated to do things, and sometimes you don't love them, but you do them because you're obligated, right? That's the lessons I learned from Spanglish.
Which is odd, and we'll get to it. But yes, so we decided, why not? We're these pop culture guys. We were talking about it on the Say Report. Why not focus our lens a little bit, looking at the films of Adam Sandler, and define our personal Adam Sandler cinematic universe, so that when one is invariably defined by the man himself, we can compare notes and see where we succeeded, where we failed, and where we fell on our face. And That's...
you know, if there's ever going to be two guys in the world that can spit shine a turd, it's the two of us. So that was also the factor for it.
That is a very good point. And I think that's why Sijin is not so quick to say this is going to be the shortest episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. And I am actually inclined to agree with him. It's just watching this film, it's pretty apparent what I think we're going to say in our final thoughts about this movie, but who knows, right? We're going to talk about it. I got my notes. I have everything that I'm doing. But I guess what I want to know from you, Sijin, in this moment, are your first impressions regarding the film Spanglish?
So Spanglish is one of those movies that I use this term a lot, but it applies to everything I use it for. So the idea being, like, it was not a movie I sat down and watched, but rather a movie that, like, was around me. I think maybe, like, the one time that I watched this movie, quotes, was, like, on a train. Like, not even a plane, but literally, like, sitting in a train seat, like, in a long-distance train seat. And they were just like, well, we've got a six-hour ride, so let's put a movie on it. This is the movie that they chose. Like, that kind of thing. It's the same way I saw You Got Mail, by the way, and I love that movie. So that context has nothing to do with my feelings one way or the other. but the idea being that, like, I never paid attention. Like, that is the bread and butter here, is like it's not a movie that I paid attention to. Because, and we're going to talk a lot about marketing in this particular episode, but there is a running sensation with this film. There's a running story with this film, that part of what happened to it is that it was sold as one thing and it was something else, blah blah blah. And I didn't ever have that misconception, and I'm not just like, oh, you know, so lucky me, or like, look how good I am at reading movies or whatever. Things never hit me in the ways that it seemed to hit everybody else. I didn't think when this movie was being made that it was going to be like a dick and fart joke Sandler movie, like a lot of people did, and thus were disappointed when it wasn't. Also, there's a large tinge of people that, like, saw it as being very, very heavily focused in the marketing on the white family, and lo and behold, they're not main characters at all in this movie. And I totally get that, because I went back and actually watched the preview for this, because I needed to, like, remind myself, because I remember this being a big thing about this film, is that the reason that it's so missed, the reason that it's not so beloved is because it was missold to people, right? So I was like, well, I got to at least watch the trailer before I watch the movie. Did that, and I don't disagree that the trailer definitely focuses super heavy on the likes of like Ataya Leone and Adam Sandler and Cloris Leachman, despite the fact that they are not the main characters of this film, main character of this film. But that is like, and that is something that I don't know, like, it didn't, that's not the part that offends me, I guess. I don't know. But there's something about the idea that this movie really hit a lot of people the wrong way, and it didn't even get the chance to do that with me as I was growing up, right? So I've just kind of grown up with, like, the mythos of Spanglish. And the truth is that for me, the mythos around it had always been that generally it is pretty looked down upon, but it is the odd one that, like, in a group of quote-unquote intellectuals, somebody will be like, actually, I very much enjoy that film. So it has this weird kind of mythos for me as being, like, the one you didn't get, I guess, is kind of really the better way to think about it. So sitting down and actually just watching it for today's episode was a bit of a trip for me because, like, I enjoyed the movie, like, blanket, just enjoyed the film as I watched it. But definitely don't love it and don't and I'm back to having this really weird feeling where it's not a movie that affects me enough for me to like embody it, like say something like a Little Nicky that we've talked about in the past, right? Or a Happy Gilmore, as I openly admitted makes me openly weep because it makes me think of my grandmother. like those movies have like really important like pieces of my soul attached to them, right? This movie never had that and didn't gain that today, so I'm kind of feeling lukewarm on the movie itself. I'm totally down to talk about a bunch of stuff in it because there's a lot of really interesting things to talk about. But in terms of my initial feelings, I didn't have many to begin with, and I don't really have many now.
That's fair. I'm really happy that you bring up the trailer, because as we are going to explore, it really was the marketing that was a big disservice to Spanglish.
The villain of this movie?
Yeah, the main villain was how they sold this film and what people thought they were getting. And the really strange thing about that is Punch Drunk Love existed. Punch Drunk Love is a film that had existed prior to this coming out. So it's not like this is the first time Adam Sandler tries his hand at a more down-to-earth or dramatic role. So I don't really understand why people felt so offended or betrayed, other than the fact that the marketing literally sold them a very different type of movie.
I mean, the other thing to think about is that the big thing about this movie that I'm really going to focus on today is I don't consider this an Adam Sandler film. He's got a bigger part than he did in Mixed Nuts, I guess, but not much more than that. So, like, that's a whole other part of this, right? So that's the other thing about it is my initial reactions is and, like, feelings when I was growing up is I also never really looked at it as an Adam Sandler movie. I'm not saying that anyone that did was, like, was fooling themselves because the marketing definitely wants you to feel that way. And that's what we'll talk about. But there's this idea being that, like, I didn't pick up on it as one because of kind of some of the other stuff that I had known about it, I guess. And, like, now that I've seen it, like, I know why I have my own feelings about it. But the other person to think about when this movie's coming out is not just Adam Sandler, like, doing this thing since, you know, not one of his own movies, and Punch Drunk Love was only a couple years ago. What is he going to do next? That kind of thing. There's also this idea that, like, James L. Brooks directed this film after As Good As It Gets, and that was, like, 10 years previously? Not 10.
It was
like,
1997. So...
Yeah, so, like, we're talking about 7 years earlier. So he is literally coming back to film in a weird way. Like we haven't seen him since the good old days of the 90s, and the movie he did was As Good As It Gets. So, like, James L. Brooks directing a movie was also another reason to, like, really pay attention to this. So the marketing really kind of does a huge disservice because, like, that's the thing to hang. That's one of the things to hang your hat on. Like,
and they do. And the trailer does mention from the writer of Terms of Endearment. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot that he did Terms of Endearment. Because for me, James L. Brooks is The Simpsons. That's what I think of of James L. Brooks.
For us, for our generation, for you and me specifically, like, yes, yeah. But we knew he was doing other things, right?
Yes. I mean, I saw As Good As It Gets. Everybody wanted to see Titanic, and I dragged a group of my friends to go see As Good As It Gets, and I wasn't really friends with that group of people anymore, even though it was a good movie. I enjoyed my time with it.
That's okay. Yeah. Titanic is one good movie out of two as well.
Exactly.
Yes, which. So,
but for me, this film was only the trailer that I saw when I was working at Blockbuster, which is the same trailer that is out there and readily available to consume right now.
Yeah.
So what this movie was to me was the speech from Adam Sandler saying, that's the job. And that's it. And him saying, that's the job. So, like, to me, it always kind of became this Adam Sandler movie, but one that I never saw.
Adam Sandler yelling and Taye Leone crying. That's whole trailer.
That's the whole trailer.
Yeah.
Is that. And the fact that my father watched it, right? They took a rental home and they watched it. And they're like, you can watch it on your own time. Because at the time, you know, I'm in school when this comes out. I'm living at college. So it's, yeah, you guys can rent it and you can enjoy it. And I'll watch it maybe with my friends or my dorm guys, whatever. And based on the reaction to it of is good, but I wouldn't watch it again. I was in no hurry to watch Spanglish in 2004, 2005, when it, you know, kind of came into my life as something that I could view. So watching it for the first time this past Monday, so what, February 9th? Yeah, February 9th, 2022, that's how you're supposed to say it. And the first time that I watched it, and I loved it. I absolutely loved my time with it. But the weird thing in my mind, and it relates directly to the show, is a lot of the times I wonder if maybe we did ourselves a disservice with the format that we chose for the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe.
Oh, no. Here we are, three seasons in, and wow, now we're going to start doing the existential crisis. This really is the villain season.
Right? I want to get it all out on the table so that we're free and clear going forward. But it's one of those situations where I wonder, had we just gone in chronological order from release, would that maybe have been better? And this is the film that proves to me, no, we're doing it the right way.
Thank you.
Because...
I agree. I wholeheartedly agree that this movie made me consider, like, man, I'm glad that, like, I didn't watch this after A, B, or C. Because, like, I think this was the right time in our own order to watch it.
Not only that, I don't think that I would have walked away from this film appreciating it the way that I do if I hadn't watched the 14 films prior to it.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't see the various Sandler roles on display from things like Billy Madison, like Hubie Halloween, and like something like Chuck and Larry last month, this film and my enjoyment of it was so fueled by seeing this different side of Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
I've watched him, I've chronicled him, and then seeing just him take it down every notch, like to be at the bottom of the notches.
Yeah, he only really lets a couple of moments come out of the, like, the obnoxious loud Sandler that we all know and love, right? I mean, I think specifically at the moment that you referenced already in the car where he's like, this is the job, or there is like one or two moments when he's in the quote unquote fight with Taye Leone. But like, other than that, like, he is a completely different character than we've ever seen before, for sure.
Yeah, specifically with this show, because, again, Punch Drunk Love had happened 2 years before.
Well, no, but, because have you seen Punch Drunk Love?
No, I haven't seen Punch Drunk Love. But also what I'm saying, like, but I know that it's...
The characteristic of his character in that is anger issues, and, like, it's basically like watching Happy Gilmore 2 in terms of his acting. So,
I'm excited when we get to it then.
Yeah, even compared to that, it is something else.
I guess I'm just talking more about not the funny guy in the room, not the funniest guy in the room, being able to be more muted, being able to be an actor and not just a clown.
Well, let's talk about why he takes this movie, right? Because after doing Punch Drunk Love and getting a whole bunch of praise, the praise is all through the lens of you've found a movie that suits your over-the-top, loud, like, angry guy. Like your angry man child comedy worked in this role, in this drama movie. That's great, isn't it? And, like, that's what all of the, like the praise that he's getting is basically, like, praising him for figuring out how to, like, use his powers for good, essentially. And I think it really pisses him off that it's not like, hey, you did a really good job changing up your act. It's, hey, you did a really good job finding a place to make your act more profitable. And he's just like, that's not the point. So he goes, and then this is the thing that he comes out with next in terms of his kind of out of his wheelhouse film. And it is like such a hard turn in the other direction. It feels like every step of the way, it is to kind of prove to those people that like what he was doing in Punch Drunk Love was more than just his normal shit. Like Punch Drunk Love, I guess what it is it feels like, and every comedic actor has this. They step out of comedy for a moment, and people are like, "Hey, that's great, good for you," and they feel like they need to do it a second time to prove it, right?
That it's not just a one-off.
It's not just
that
a
it's not
fluke.
a
It's
fluke,
right. So like this is him doing his second outing to prove it's not a fluke, because before Punch Drunk Love, he really doesn't have much in the realm of things that are not just his own movies, besides like what, like Bulletproof and maybe if you go back to Overboard, right?
I mean, Going Overboard,
Mixed Nuts too, I guess
Bulletproof,
I should.
Mixed Nuts, and then like even to some extent something like Airheads, because Pip is a very muted character.
Yeah, but we talked a lot about
Well, we didn't. We listened
they
to
talked a
alternate
lot.
versions of ourselves
Yeah, but
discuss
mention
it.
but the idea of discussing how it was a very Sandler-esque portrayal
Yes.
of a meager human, right? Like it could have just been another character in Eight Crazy Nights, really, right? Like I like it wasn't anything that was like mind-blowingly different from what he had done before. It was just cool to see him aim it in a different direction. This is him with a totally different weapon in his arsenal. Like this movie definitely succeeds in that case for sure. Again, very much like the movie. I'm gonna reiterate this probably 1,000 times this episode. Go see this movie. Spend your time with it. It is a bit of a long one. I kind of leaning into what I was saying about how it kind of leads the charge for some stuff in terms of like sometimes these like comedies don't always have to be funny. And also sometimes they're a little bit longer than you expect.
I thought
And
of
don't
the
have to
only thing I
rush
could
with that
think of
shit.
this whole movie was Marriage Story, the Kylo Ren and the
Yeah, the
Black
way.
Widow movie.
Yeah, I don't think it's Black Widow, but is it? Is
It's
it Scarlett
Scarlett
Johansson?
Johansson, yeah. I couldn't think of Adam Driver's name. So I mean, of course I knew ScarJo. And there's Noah Baumbach, and there are moments that just felt so like,
Yeah.
thank you so much, James L. Brooks, for doing
Well,
Spanglish and
and he
for
was
it
on the
not
road with
catching
Baumbach at some
fire.
point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Spanglish opens a lot of doors for Sandler that I don't think Punch Drunk Love would have done on its own. So I want to like cut that tether right now, because it is important to note that this was like what he did after the whole Punch Drunk Love of it all. But like there is so much going on in this movie that is trying to divorce itself from that like we got to make sure that it's not just him like being like I don't want to separate it into two worlds of funny Sandler and drama Sandler. Like he is we this whole show is about making him more complicated than that, right? And I want to make sure we do that.
And I think that, yeah, and it worked for me. He was this more complicated role as John Klasky in Spanglish, and I was happy that I've been doing my homework with the Adam Sandler films to enjoy
Gonna
it.
call you out on that one too, not to keep like braiding over, like to like stretch out this one section. I think that my issue with this movie comes down to the fact that while I think Sandler as a whole comes out looking more complex as an actor, the character isn't complex. The character is unfortunately quite simple, and I think that's one of the big issues that I have with this film is that every character is very
Oh, we'll
simplistic on its
get there.
surface.
Don't worry. We
Right,
will
right,
get
right.
there.
I just want to make, because you mentioned that this was a more complex character, and I don't think that's what it is. I think that it's a more complex career because of this character.
Right, so I guess the proper nomenclature to use, it's a more complex role. Because the character is not complex, but what you have to do as an actor to portray that
Okay,
character,
yeah.
what you're bringing to it, how you're preparing to play the role of John Klasky, is far more involved than the other stuff that we've explored so far in this show.
Yeah,
Is
I've
that
caught up.
fair?
Yeah, I'm on the
That
same page. I've
okay.
caught up.
All right, good. Because yeah, we'll talk to it. Because honestly, the question that this film leaves me with is how does this get made? How does this get made is the
In 2004. How does this get made in 2004
Yeah,
specifically?
exactly. I mean, and that's usually what that means. In 2004, how does this film happen?
Yeah.
And that's a question that we're going to seek to answer as we go forward into it. Because
Sure.
I got a lot. I have so many questions about like the fact that James L. Brooks is writing this story from the perspective of an undocumented Mexican immigrant.
Yes,
Like,
that is a very good question to ask, Devin. Yeah, with that in
so,
mind,
yeah.
we should probably talk about what this movie is actually about.
We probably should. Do you have any facts and figures on this one? How did this film do? This is the
Oh,
same
yes,
year as
absolutely. Yeah.
50 First Dates, which is one other thing that I wanted like bring up and just highlight is Adam Sandler already had a movie in 2004.
Yeah.
And Spanglish trailers probably played before that movie.
Yeah.
And around that movie.
So it's coming out in February. No, sorry. Reading that
it's
wrong.
December.
It's coming out in December. I was reading the date today that it updated. Sorry. December. It comes out in December of 2004, so it's end of the year, but that is notably award season,
award
right?
Season.
So a big thing to think about. So the movies that it comes out against are fucking like The Aviator and Flight of the Phoenix. I think if I was to look at like I think the movie that wins the weekend that year is fucking Jim Carrey's Series of Unfortunate Events. Like, what a poke of the eye to Oscars season. But at this point, like you've had, just to give an idea for anybody that was half paying attention, this is the same year that like Bridget Jones 3, I think, comes out.
No, Bridget, right? Jones 2. Edge of Reason is 2.
Okay, Bridget Jones 2.
Because 3 didn't come out till the 2010s.
Yeah. This is the same year as like SpongeBob SquarePants movie, Finding Neverland. I think the Disney movie that year is, they're still on the like the Disney 1 year, Pixar the next, right? So this is Incredibles, right?
Yeah.
That year.
So
like so these are the movies that it opens up against, like not opens up against, that is purely saved for the fucking Aviator. I cannot believe that. And Flight of the Phoenix, like, just like these two, like Flight of the Phoenix is like that weird remake with Dennis Quaid, right? If I remember,
that's
correctly.
The movie I saw the weekend that Spanglish came out. I went with my grandfather and had a great time,
man. I think I probably saw a Series of Unfortunate Events that weekend. I'm not gonna lie.
That sounds like something you would be doing.
A Jim Carrey movie? Yes, I'm on board. So that's kind of the year that we're in. That's also the same year that we see Ray. Just in terms of weird Oscar movies that pop up later on.
Is it the year that Crash is? Because Crash wins that next Oscars, right?
Is it 2004? I don't know. I'd have to like really dive into some stuff for Crash. But as far as like as how it does financially, like it's pretty straightforward. Like the movie. Hold on, I got the numbers right here.
I mean, I hope you have it there, because
we
divvy up the stuff.
Yeah. No. I'm sorry. I'm literally looking
it's
at
okay.
it. I'm having a hard time parsing through it, because now they've gone and made IMDb and Box Office Mojo unreadable. I'm never going to stop complaining about this. But the budget of the movie is like an $80 million movie, and it doesn't do great. It domestically is a failure. It only makes $42 million. It worldwide gains another $55. So, I'm sorry, I misread that. Internationally only gains 12 and makes 55, so it never makes its money back. It is a flop. This is a straight-up flop of a film.
Also contributing to the villainous portrayal of Adam Sandler, a movie that proves to people, this is not what you should be doing.
This is not what people
want to see.
So there's,
and
like,
that's
this
sad.
Really
I don't...
weird, well, there's this really weird element to it where, like, they put Adam Sandler front and center on the poster, and they pump him up in the preview, and again, he's not the main character of this movie. And the thing is like, that you could get away with that if the name of the movie wasn't literally Spanglish. I'm sorry, I don't really want to talk about this already complex concept of mingling of the English and Spanish languages and the ways in which that is kind of a weird term that borders on problematic in certain uses, you know what I mean? And then, like, slap that on an Adam Sandler film. I'm probably not going to waste my time with that even on a good day. Like that is such a weird way to push this movie. Like, when the movie is so heavily focused on this young woman and her struggle to bring her and her daughter to this country and completely, like, blindsided by some of the like little details that are just skipped over in her story, which we'll talk about after the synopsis. But like that kind of stuff is like hugely important stuff that we should be talking about. And then you're just trying to pitch this as an Adam Sandler comedy. And it's just like, what are you doing? Like Tay Leone is like bawling her eyes out in what appears to be six different scenes of this film. And lo and behold, it is. It's just
one of which doesn't make it into the movie, but is the most compelling. Her just losing her shit in the shower.
Yeah. It's a fucking wild marketing campaign for this movie. Because it doesn't work. Like, it doesn't pay off. because it doesn't sell well, and it kind of goes towards the whole mythos that Sandler alone cannot sell tickets, which is insane to think about, because we constantly talk about the idea that, like, especially with, like, Netflix now that he's doing the whole Netflix deal, is they just put Sandler's face on the front poster and suddenly it gets 1 million views in the first day and then 10 million by the end of the first weekend. So, like, it's crazy to think that they failed at what was the easiest marketing ploy in the world, and that's just put Adam Sandler's face on it. So, like, it is a hard nosedive for the marketing on this film screwing up so bad.
Yeah, it really is. And especially, he's already hot after 50 First Dates. We talked about it. We talked about the success of that. It's not crazy that, like, you should have some carryover audience. At least enough carryover audience that in that first weekend, you recoup your budget.
You at least get your budget back.
Yeah.
Also, $80 million. I mean, it has to be, because a lot of the stuff is just filmed on location. They just travel everywhere in this movie. A
lot of on-location stuff. There's also some weird, like, special effects elements.
The stupid car stuff with Taylor Leone and Thomas Hayden Church at that point. It was like watching a movie from the 1950s. We've got to get into this movie more, but you've got to.
Yeah, I got to do the synopsis. Yourself. So let me take a. I'm gonna drink some water, vamp for me real quick. Cause
oh yeah, this is the part of the show where Siege and vamps.
Beautiful, excellent, exactly what we needed. Flor Moreno is an undocumented Mexican immigrant that can understand but not speak English, who is willing to do whatever it takes to provide for her 12-year-old daughter, Christina, even if that means taking a 6-day-a-week, 7, 8, 12-hours-a-day job as a housekeeper and juvenile chauffeur for the Klasky family. The Klaskys are matriarch Deborah, a chronic sufferer of low self-esteem, Deb's mother Evelyn, former jazz singer and current alcoholic, daughter Bernice, a unique spirit who fails to see eye-to-eye with her mother, 9-year-old son Georgie, who did something, and patriarch John, a top chef that works nights and is portrayed by Adam Sandler. Flora was prepared to work her hardest for the Klaskys, but what she never could have expected were the first world problems of an upper class family in 2004 Los Angeles. Deb, currently feeling adrift in her life without a job to focus or define her, has turned her attention on Bernie, primarily getting her to lose the weight required to fit into a size 8. In addition to the issues with her mother, Bernie is being driven to a state of high anxiety over the pressure put on her to excel at her private school. John is rattled because his restaurant has been granted a 4-star review in the Times, and he now feels new pressure to maintain that success in the industry that brings him joy, while also being made to feel like a bad husband by Deb and powerless to intervene in the ongoing battle between his wife and daughter. Flora proves herself invaluable to the family, so much so that when they plan to rent a property in Malibu for the summer, Deb insists she comes live with them, a prospect that immediately spooks Flor, as her daughter would make doing so impossible. But when Deb offers to allow her daughter to come stay as well, and mentions it might mean having to hire someone else should she refuse, Flora is left no choice but compliance. As the summer goes on, Deb is thrilled to have a project that appreciates her and Christina, causing friction with Flora. Fearful of losing her child, Flora finds an unlikely ally in John, who Flora declares has the emotions of a Mexican woman as her first impression, but that kindred spirit allows both parties to empathize with the other's situation. However, it isn't long before empathy matures into something more. Back in the real world, our novella comes to a head when Flora, fearful of losing her daughter to the fantasies promised by Deb, quits the job with the Klaskys on the very same night Deb confesses to having been engaged in an affair with their realtor for the past 11 weeks. We don't learn if the marriage will ever recover from this indiscretion, but we are left with Christina learning a valuable lesson about finding acceptance of oneself from these events.
Excellent, Devin. I have a small synopsis myself I care to read.
I'd love to hear it, because that was hard, and I had to gloss over so much, but then I thought, this movie glosses over so much, and mm-hmm. I'm going to focus on the big main points.
Yeah, well, so I went even vaguer than you, but it's a pretty straightforward one. I wrote down in my notes, yes, the classic tale of a poor Mexican illegal immigrant abused by a rich, successful white couple told by a successful white filmmaker.
Through the filter, let's just build on your beautiful synopsis there, because also, golf clap, through the filter of a admissions letter written to Princeton University by the undocumented Mexican immigrant's daughter, who was also herself an undocumented immigrant.
Wow. I mean, like, what a clumsy framing device that they go back to
too many times.
All the wrong places. Yeah. Yes. They either don't use it well enough, so they don't frame it well enough, because there's so many scenes that we see that there's no way this kid would ever have any knowledge of. So, like, they can't be narrating those scenes, right? But at the same time, they don't do it enough in other areas. They do it too much in other areas. So it's like, you either need to really focus on the fact that this kid is the one narrating the story, or you need to drop that shit quick. You cannot dwell on it this much, because it's just, it's really ruining the whole immersion of the concept here. Like,
yeah, I'm glad that I'm not the only one who felt that way. Because as soon as it started, I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And then immediately she's like, because this letter is public record, I'm just going to say that we traveled economy class to get to America. And it's like, oh, okay. And then the thought that I'm stuck with as we're supposed to be learning about these characters is, could this letter get this person deported? Like, if Princeton decided to report her, what would happen?
No, I will say that an element, and this is, the film doesn't set this up. This is me overlaying my own, like, knowledge and experience with having family in this country that is not... not necessarily always been in the safest position. Let's put it that way.
That's a lovely way. Traveling economy.
But this idea being that, like, you don't know what's going to be the thing. So everything becomes a trigger, and you need to be careful about that, right? And that's that is the life you lead, is you lead this life. And so one of the things that I mentioned earlier is that there's moments that where they just kind of just skip over hugely important details that are fascinating to me that really should have been explored more, considering how much this movie is literally about them. But the idea that they moved here and then didn't leave this one part of the city for 6 years. It took them 6 years to gain the confidence to walk outside of the city, the small area of the city
barrio.
Where they felt safe, right? Like this area that they felt was going to be their home, like they couldn't be there anymore. And that's like...
I mean, that's the other thing. The fact that they couldn't be there anymore, they totally could be there.
Yeah.
It's because the mother is hyper-protective of her daughter, so she doesn't want to leave her alone at night. Yeah.
The other big thing we need to say right here and right now, and you can, maybe this is something we need to talk about, Dev, maybe you'll disagree, but there's no ifs, ands, or buts about this. This isn't even going to be saved for my blue, although it'll probably play into my blue. But at the end of the day, this movie is sexist towards women. like just hardcore. The women in this movie are always the ones with the problem, and guys are always the ones that either have it figured out or don't need to figure it out because they're just fine. Like,
I kind of disagree, but it's going to be an interesting discussion. There.
Look at the way that Georgie is treated versus any other kid in this movie. Look at the way that
who the hell is Georgie? I know I mentioned him in my synopsis, but
right.
Yeah.
But I guess my point is that the movie doesn't focus on them because they're not the ones that need to be fixed. The women are the ones that always have a problem of some kind. And this is good. This is the first moment in the movie where you kind of start to get that vibe of that. You just don't pinpoint it until some of the stuff that happens later. But like that idea being that they literally upend their entire life because of clearly something happened between her mother and her father. And we're never quite given the details on that, much like we're not given the details on much of fuck all in this movie. But this idea being that, like, we understand that there is an issue there. And because of that, her mom is hyper aware and sensitive about advances of men is what we're supposed to believe. But the movie hasn't built that up or earned that yet. So it goes from this whole friggin' thing of them being like, oh my God, like we're alone. It's just the two of us. We take care of each other. We love one another. Also, now that you're going through puberty, we have to leave Mexico. What? So in a weird way, at that point, it almost feels racist more than sexist. But then you learn later on that it's not about the fact that they were in Mexico that her mom was freaking out. It's because she's a woman and she fears the advances of all men. The end. And that's we're never given more than that. And so this movie is sexist in the ways that it lays on these important conversations that like that women have and should have and that we should have with women and all of that. But at the end of the day, it never gives them any substance or foundation. So it's just like, well, we all know women are like this. And it's just like, no, can't do that.
It treats it weirdly like an established fact that everyone knows is.
Exactly.
And then, because that's an established fact, here's room for story not even related to that. We just took 5 minutes to confirm that we're all aware of this, right?
And it feels uber offensive to me now in 2022 because, let's be honest, a lot of stuff that's happened over the last few years where people have really been called out specific people have been very called out for using feminism as a shield in order to, like, just get away with the shit they always get away with, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that you have this story that could elevate itself by pointing out the fact that it does focus on so many women, and it does focus on these women going through different struggles in different classes, in different points in their life, in different races, all of this sort of stuff that it is talking about. At the end of the day, it's not saying anything important about any of them. So it's like it's wearing this veneer of like being such a female like led film, but at the end of the day, it just doesn't do anything. And that sucks. That is more angering to me than if they had done anything worse. I don't know.
I understand where you're coming from. I guess the only reason where I draw some issue with what you say, and it's not even really an issue, it's just what I would point to as, I don't know, the reason why Florida connects with John is because of how unmasculine he is. There's that moment in the car where she's like, having grown up with the idea of basically machismo, but yeah, they anglicize it so that the audience will understand it to, yeah, Mexican macho. And he really has more the emotions of a Mexican woman. And like, that's such a weird thing because it's like Florida's attracted to him because he is a man, but he acts like a woman.
I mean, it's because of this aversion that we have been informed of that she just has towards men.
Right.
So it's like that's the only reason. But I would say that for me, I read that as this idea that they are allowing men in this movie to, across the board, all men in general, be more complex, because you do have this man that is on display this way. And you do have Thomas Hayden Church that shows up at some point and he's much more macho. And you have other men that show up and you know, they know what the job is. You know, you see it in Sandler's Kitchen and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, like, they allow a complexity of men to be present in this film, whereas like women are just extremely one note. Because the other thing I would say about John is that you learn by the end of the movie all of this stuff that like there is strength in him. Like, you learn the idea that like sometimes strength is not muscles, right? And that's supposed to be the whole arc with him,
yeah,
is that sometimes strength is keeping your family together in the worst, you know, worst situations. And like that's character growth. That's important. He is just, there's never a moment where he is not successful in this film, like as a character, just blanket. There's just not a part where he falters.
But
everything,
his fatal flaw falls into
a bed of flowers.
His fatal flaw is that I can't fail. And that's so hard to be this constantly successful,
yeah,
individual.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh my God,
he treats his kids, and like the kids, yeah, and the kids love him.
Yeah.
Like, and it's always Tay Leone, the one that's doing it wrong. And like, no wonder she's in the state that she's in. So like, we're supposed to believe that somehow it lends an ear of just this real superiority complex of men over the whole thing. And as a guy, like, it makes it hard to watch in some scenes where I'm just like, okay, this is really uncomfortable, because like Tay Leone is having some real serious issues that she should be allowed to talk about, but it feels like because she's expressing them, she is somehow the bad person in this scene. And she says that. So it's like mind blowing, because she outwardly says, I feel like you're making me into the bad guy just for feeling feelings. And he's just like, I'm not trying to.
He's
and
like, just like, chicka, chicka, chicka.
Yeah. And he's like, let me just grab your tits. Like, what are you doing? Oh my God. Yeah. This movie just has some real issues for me in the ways in which it treats people in general, but like very specifically the way it treats its supposed like female leads.
So I understand where you're coming from, but it's a very different way to paint the film. It's not the one that I saw it through. It's not the filter I saw it through. Really, I just saw none of these people know how to communicate. And it's,
yeah,
not just a language barrier. It's straight up like nobody is really having a conversation.
Well, right. That's the, it's babble like for dum-dums. Like
yeah,
that's what it is. Like this idea that like we all can't communicate, never mind language barriers. We just have gender barriers, age barriers, belief barriers. Like there's all of this stuff. Yeah, that is definitely what we're, that is, I believe, supposed to be what James L. Brooks is attempting to do.
Yeah.
And he does do that in many scenes. there are definitely moments where that kind of stuff kind of really comes into play. I do think this is an intelligently written film in a lot of spaces. One of the scenes that we considered doing today was the one where Floor and what is his name in this movie? David or John?
John.
I keep wanting to call him David, but I know that's not right.
Yeah.
So John and Floor are in the car after the fight, and she is quit or is about to quit, all that sort of stuff, and they're about to go on their big date. He's going to drop her off at the bus stop, and he says, "Wait, before you go, can we hang out?" And she's just like, "You want to hang out?" And he's like, "Yes, sure, but only if you explain one thing to me. What? What does hang out mean?" And there's this moment where you laugh because it's all about Spanglish and the fact that she's been learning English and she doesn't get this phrase, and that's really cute and all. But then if you think about it, there's a deeper way that that line can be delivered and should have been delivered and wasn't delivered in this movie. That is about the idea of being like, it could mean that, or it could also mean, what do you want to happen tonight? And that's just, and like, that is on display all over this movie in the writing. The problem is that it's so marred in so much other bullshit, it never comes through in the actual film.
Agreed. I mean, because that scene where Tia Leone is calling herself the literal bad guy, mm-hmm. like, the way I viewed it is he's trying to have the conversation with her, but she's not letting him get that word in edgewise. So then he does that because he's like, this has ended these things before. And it's not good. It's just what he has learned and what he's been conditioned to.
Sure.
But it should be a discussion about the fact that me saying to our son that I'm not as mad at you is giving our son a chance to, like, move forward and to open up the lines of communication. Because if we're just angry with our son for whatever he did, then there's nowhere to go from there.
Sure, but I think the bigger thing to glean from that is we're supposed to believe is that he's always been that one of the two parents, right? And you can't do that as a parent. Even I, as somebody without a child, knows you got to share
the responsibility of it. But it also feels in that situation, and it feels like we also just missed the scene based on the trailer and the fact that she's screaming in the shower. It feels like there was an interaction between Tia Leone and Georgie that just didn't make it to the finished film. So then it's right on top of each other. And it literally then comes across as not a united front from the parents.
Yeah.
Because we have no idea what Georgie did.
Could have been. Oh my God. I know. But that's like James Earl Brooks uses that trick too often in this film.
Yeah.
Like, the idea being, like, I'm going to drop a hint about a bigger world. And, like, one or two little pepperings of the idea that there's a loose thread that never got tied up. That's fun, and it makes the world feel bigger than the movie itself. That's good screenwriting. Doing that every other page and then just not tying up loose ends or not filling in the blanks, that at some point it becomes bad screenwriting.
And I fully believe, and the fact of the matter is, because this movie is what this movie is, because it didn't really move any mountains, because it just sort of came and went, and for Adam Sandler fans, it just has this stink of, oh my God, I felt betrayed by the marketing, I felt betrayed by Adam Sandler, and for, like, the rest of the world, it doesn't make any noise. There's not a lot of, like, looking into this film. It's like what the original script was or what the original cut was. Like, I think it's 17 trivia things on IMDb for this film.
Yeah.
And that's, like, that's sad to me because, honestly, there feels like, based on the scenes we see with him, that Georgie had a full story.
Yeah, probably.
That was probably shot and then just probably left on the cutting room floor. Because of little moments that are used in the trailer that lead me to believe, well, there was more with this. And
there was definitely more filmed.
Yeah,
sure.
Definitely more filmed. Because
literal evidence that there was more filmed than we saw.
Yeah, because the fact that, like, if she had just had an interaction and then the dad comes around and he's like, I'm not as mad at your mother. But then the situation is, but I am disappointed. Like, you do understand that what you did was wrong. Right? Yeah. Like, he doesn't come in to be supportive to her feelings at all. Like,
exactly.
It's just
so... But he's a perfect dad. He is a perfect person. He is a perfect human. He's just perfect. Like, his character is upsettingly perfect to the point where I am on Tia Leone's side for a lot of the feelings that she's feeling towards him. Because, like, sometimes she just wants the man to have an emotion and go through it with him. And he doesn't want to share that part of himself. And that's not good. Like, that's just not healthy. That's not, like, it's weird. But this movie, I can't tell if this movie wants me to think it is or not. This movie doesn't seem to be questioning any of that shit about him, you know?
That's crazy. That's crazy to me. But what's crazy to me is the fact that 50 minutes into this episode, the reveal that you are Team Tia Leone and I am Team Adam Sandler.
Oh, I'm not Team Tia Leone either, because okay. I do think that there is definitely some issues there that need to get worked out, and she seems to be making no effort to actually work on her issues. She like there's no mention of her talking to like a doctor or a therapist at some point and saying like, I am having these feelings within myself about my life and things like that. Like she's just expecting to just yell her problems away. So like she also is like in a weird position for me. But my problem is that meta, why, like the metaverse of this film is, I just don't like, I'm more on her side than his, because this movie is going out of its way to want me to hate her, and I refuse to follow that line of thought, because until they give me a good reason to, I'm not going to just hate her just because she's a woman on screen. And this movie never gets to that point where it gives you a good enough reason to not be on her side. It doesn't give you a good enough reason to ever be on his either, but that's just it, right? Other than the fact that we're supposed to believe that he is just perfect in every way.
I don't know. I think it, I mean, having watched it the two times, it was really difficult to root for her or empathize with her. But it's interesting what you're saying on that other level. It's because we're never given anything from her to make her feel like somebody we would even want to give that a chance to feel any sort of way from. From moment one, she is kind of the worst person on screen based on the portrayal. Exactly. I mean, the Monica walks into the glass window and she's like, I'm not mad at you. Here's $40.
Yeah.
Like,
it's like she's just,
what?
She is just so like, this movie never makes an effort to make her a likable character. And that doesn't make me not like her. It makes me not like the movie. That's my big thing at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is not a film. If I wasn't doing it for the show, I don't think I would have ever seen this film twice. Because at the end of the day, I feel like nothing happens. Like, the lesson that Christina gets from this movie to finish off her Princeton admission letter, first of all, she should not get into Princeton. I know this is the last I'm going to talk about the framing device that is very, very out of place for this movie. I don't understand it, but like, if that were the admission letter that I received at Princeton, I would throw it away just as fast as I went to Hawaii and learned the importance of the word aloha. Like, because I can't believe that Dean of Admissions continued reading this letter
after certain sentences that we then hear from it for sure.
It's just,
I will say that I think that there was supposed to be some idea that the story was, and this goes down again to some of the writing being super problematic, but like not outwardly so you don't think about it, is that I think there's supposed to be this some element of the idea that like, well, English is not her first language to a lot of that. And it's just like, fuck off. Like, first of all, like she picks up the language real quick in this film. Like, that's supposed to be the whole thing about her versus her mother, is that like she's like laughing because her mom can't pick up on idioms and things like that. And like she realizes she shouldn't in those moments. And that's great. But like that letter that we're supposed to believe is many years later.
At least six is what I would figure. I figure she's 18. So
there's elements in which the writing was so bad that I was supposed to be that I sat here wondering, am I supposed to forgive this kind of writing because English is not her first language? I don't feel like I should, especially at this point in her life. But like, I couldn't tell if it was purposely written badly or just written badly.
Yeah, I don't. And then there's like one moment
also,
that
the 30-year-old woman playing her voiceover made no sense to me. I couldn't. At one point, I had to tell myself, "It's the admissions officer's voice you're actually hearing because she's reading it, right?" Like, right.
And if it's the admissions officer who's reading it and hearing the voice, though, that is definitely disproven by the fact that all of the other letters that we hear in that opening scene are
written by
whoever wrote it.
Yeah.
It would make sense why Amy Garcia as the narrator would continue to read this story, because perhaps she's going to have shared some elements with this other young Latina woman's experience.
Yeah.
It's weird. So strange. And I don't, I don't get it. I don't understand it. And that's where I lie with this film, is a lot of the choices I straight up do not understand. The only other one I want to talk about, and then we'll move forward with the schedule on this show, is when he ends up giving away 20% of the restaurant, and Tia Leone is very upset about that. And that scene kind of makes no sense to me.
Yeah, so why does he get, like, it doesn't make sense from square one for me. Why is he giving up part of the restaurant?
So Pietro, his sous chef, right? Yeah, his second in command.
Phil needs food. Yep.
is very much one of the reasons why he is successful. Why he's able to have a life at home and the successful restaurant is because he has surrounded himself with good people. That's a thing that is just supposed to exist in that
moment. So it is to an employee, right? Like, I somehow couldn't figure out if we were talking about him giving it away, like, to charity or something. Like, no. I lost the thread at some point.
So after the 4-star review comes out, which that we'll talk about that after New World Borrowed Blue, because there's other stuff we need to talk about, but we need to break it up a little bit before we continue with this, because we verge going on down a dangerous path. After that 4-star review, where the restaurant is now the hottest shit, I guess in the United States, based upon the
review from the Times that must have flown out a person across the country to taste his food. Yeah.
There's also the LA Times. So I'm like, they get multiple copies of the New York Times to their house. I don't get this. We're not talking about it right now. We'll talk about that part later. His sous chef says to him, you know, off of the heat of that article, I'm getting offers to open my own restaurant. People understand that part of your success is me, and backers want me to go out and start my own restaurant.
You never go for the guy at the top. You go for the guy right underneath the guy at the top. That's how you start your new business.
That's how you start your new business. That's business 101. Exactly. So he goes to John, and John's like, no, but you can't, because if I lose you, I could never be the father that I am at home and have the restaurant. Like, you are super important to me. And then Pietro twirls his non-existent mustache because he now has all of the cards and all of the chips to bargain with.
Yeah, I mean, as he should. That's the important part about this conversation for me is, like, this is what this movie does, it puts John in these awkward moments where he suddenly has to kind of, like, give up a part of himself, and I'm supposed to believe what a good guy he is for doing that, but every time it's a situation in where I'm like, yeah, but he should be doing these things. He shouldn't get a pat on the back for doing the right thing.
For doing the right thing.
He does all the time in this movie.
Yeah, you're not wrong. But that's the thing, is so then he gives him 20% of the restaurant, which we don't know how much he owns, but honestly, it feels like 100%.
Yeah, I mean,
he
the doesn't way that have... we're supposed to believe it, it's an 80-20 split in that moment.
So that guy is getting kind of less than he should be owed there. The fact that John only has to part with 20% of the business to retain him and thus maintain his certain status of living where he only works nights. He's not in the kitchen early in the morning starting prep and preparing a menu. He has a good second in command who handles all that. And then he comes in at night to cook. Maybe. Like 20% is nothing in terms of it. And her whole, why didn't we have this discussion? And I understand it. It's like a big financial decision. But at the end of the day, is she involved in the restaurant in any other way other than the fact that she's married to the owner?
I mean, if their family finances are tied up in it, and again, the movie doesn't make the effort to explain any of this to us, if the family finances are tied up in the restaurant and he just gave away 20% of the family's earnings, then yes, he should probably have a conversation with his family about what he's going to do. That being said, he can go into that conversation saying, this is what I'm going to do, and I don't think you're going to be able to change my mind, and then, like, go from there. But on the other hand, if that's not the way that the finances are set up in the house, which is not unusual, especially 2004, you know, like the idea being that, like, they have separate finances, that maybe they've got like a shared pool somewhere. Like they don't bother like even hinting at this. I'm not saying they need to like dive into their goddamn bank records and prove to us that he's not being a shithead. Like, we can believe he's not if we're just given one or two little pieces of dialogue where all he needs to say in that moment where she's like, we should have talked about this, he should have just been like, it's my money, I could do what I want with it, if he had just said that once. But he's even too good of a guy to even throw that
that as the thing.
Yeah,
but clearly, based on the evidence that we're shown, her losing her job does not affect that house at all, right?
Yeah.
She has been out of work for 4 months. We're told that. And also, kind of, I'm a stay-at-home mom now, but I need a housekeeper and person to drive my kids around.
I mean, like, we can't ignore the fact that they casually drop that mom used to be a hugely famous jazz singer, to the point where she sold an almost 100,000 copy, like, record of a jazz record in, like, her heyday. Like, there's also family money implied on top of the money he's bringing in.
Yeah, exactly. So, and also the fact that I just gave away 20% of the restaurant, but we're going to be able to rent a property in Malibu for the entire summer.
Yeah.
Like, they're fine. And then him, the whole time that, like, he didn't get to enjoy that property, he's still going to work in the city.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just who it hits kind of different. In that whole moment, the 20% of my business thing, because the reason that he gives that up, and like you said, we don't really see it affect him or anything, is mostly so that he can be there for his kids and his wife and his family. And so for her to be upset about the 20% of the business, it's like, you're not understanding why I gave that up. And I think that's what's upsetting to him more. Like,
I mean, yeah, sure. Like, there is definitely elements to the idea that there are deeper conversations this couple should be having, like, all across the board. That's the whole thing with this couple in this movie. Yeah. So what's crazy to me is that we have spent all this time, and we have not ignored Floor or what's
Floor?
Her
name? Floor.
And what's her daughter's name?
It's Christina.
Christina, right? You know, not that we've like ignored them entirely from this, but like, I cannot express to anybody that has not seen this movie yet how much this movie is really, really, really about Floor. Like, in a thousand ways, this is a movie that starts its first scene talking about her and goes and fades to black in the end with on her face. This is her movie. So the ways in which this film is just pushed as being about this other couple, like, what this couple is to her are antagonists to her life in an attempt to make a better life for her and her family. And they're not portrayed that way. This movie becomes just about them for 40 minutes in the middle. It's very weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And
the structure is just bizarre.
It is. Yeah. Cause it's not their movie. It's not their movie at all, but they're the ones who are given all the story beats and elements. And before we go into that, we're going to take a little break from the dish session on Spanglish, because there's a lot more to talk about. And we're going to do that old, reliable Adam Sandler cinematic universe, something new, something old, something borrowed, and something blue, where we apply what we learn about the universe so far to the film that we watch for this episode. And name something that would be new to the universe, something old that already existed within the universe, something borrowed from the rest of cinema, and then something blue, definition to be determined. So, Sijin, this was hard in this movie.
Yeah.
So I'll let you go first. Why not?
Thanks, man. This was a hard movie to apply a lot of our normal formula to, because in a lot of ways, I cannot stress this enough. It's not an Adam Sandler movie. And I thought if we were going to be in a weirder place, like, I thought we were going to be further down the line and closer to the Sandler original crew to do this kind of thing. Like, let's be honest. I thought the first one we were going to talk about was going to be like The Zookeeper, or God forbid, Here Comes the Boom or something. I thought it was going to be like one of these other ones that was, again, much more relatable to the Sandler verse. So it really threw me for a loop that Spanglish is the one that really kind of pushed our formula to like a little too far for my comfort. But with that in mind, we start with new, right?
That's where we're going. Yeah, we want to start with new.
So this is the first time that we've ever seen a motivated Sandler. Like, we kind of hinted at this earlier. This is a character we've never seen from him, but I have dubbed it the motivated Sandler. This is the guy that can get the shit done when he wants to get it done. And that's very key for later conversations. But this idea being that, like, this is the first time where, like, he has goals and he meets those goals. He exceeds those goals, and he has people around him that are more less stable than he is, and he's responsible for taking care of. And like, and he's good at it. There's not like a fault in his body. Like it's while the movie suffers because of that, I can't deny that as a character, like it's a brand new character for him.
It's interesting because it is definitely a brand new character for him, but it also weirdly builds on like someone like Happy Gilmore, where we talk about the guy who can kind of do no wrong. Like that's the thing that we explored about that character. And it's actually one of the issues that I had with watching Happy Gilmore immediately following something like Billy Madison. And, you know, it was exactly a year ago today that we talked about Happy, in the fact that if nothing really is going to get in his way, if everything just sort of kind of works out constantly, it's not as relatable as your usual Adam Sandler character.
Yeah, it's hard to relate to a character where everything is great for them because fuck you, my life is not. So motivated Sandler is what I have dubbed this version of our boy,
it's just so interesting that like Happy Gilmore has something that he's working towards, but you could never call him motivated. But it's weird that they're kind of the two sides of that same coin in my mind as you declare him a motivated Sandler in this film. To which I, and this is a stretch, and I'm sorry, this is the most supporting character Adam Sandler that we have seen in one of these movies that we've explored.
He's the kindest. Like end of the day, he is the kindest Sandler we have seen, for sure. Yeah, no, I mean, it kind of goes hand in hand with the motivated part of him. Like, he's just a better person in this movie than we've ever seen him be before. And that's not a good thing. I use the term better, and that's loaded, because it sounds like what I'm saying is that it's the best character he's ever done. Disagree.
No, don't.
Because of the fact that he is a better person, he becomes much less interesting to me to watch and much less fun to be around a lot of the time.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? It's perfectly summed up as he can do no wrong when he is pouring that beer with just no regard for the glass. And he still manages to stop it so that it does not flow over. That is so annoying to me as I think about it. But also, more what I'm talking about, that like Adam Sandler in these Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe films, he's been the main character.
Yep.
And he is not the main character of this movie
that
was sold as an Adam Sandler vehicle.
Exactly. And so a lot of the stuff that we are pointing towards are definitely things that would make more sense and definitely have to be present if he was the main character. So I think that's the other thing that I need to kind of come to terms with. And I mean, I'm not going to for my notes because I didn't while we were watching it. But like, as I'm like thinking back on this movie, is I really need to make sure that I don't fall into the trap of thinking about it as the Adam Sandler movie that failed for me. And instead thinking about like the little indie film that people didn't really pay attention to at the time, but like actually really like it is like, I say indie film on an $80 million budget,
production.
Yeah, let me put it this way. Artisan, right? Like what's the term for when Robert Rodriguez or Tarantino do a film, right? Like one of those
art house. It's the art house picture. And to think of this as an art house picture makes perfect sense. Because everything Noah Baumbach has ever done is an art house picture.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's that idea that it is the singular artist's vision that is on screen, and you rarely get that opportunity, but it is. It is James Earl Brooks' like story that he then gets to direct, and he puts these people in these roles, right? Like, I have to constantly go back to that thought when I'm talking about it. But for right now, as we focus on Sandler, should we move on to Old?
I think it's time to move on to Old, and I'll go first, and I'm going to take possibly the easiest one, which is introducing. Which feels real strange, but you look at something like Billy Madison, where it was introducing the woman who plays Veronica Vaughn.
Oh, yeah.
Bridget Wilson. Going,
yeah, so the idea that in more Sandler-heavy-led movies, and I mean that behind the scenes, it is a tool for him to bring people on screen that he likes working with and we may have not gotten the chance to see before. And it's been cool to see him do that a few times with people.
Yeah, but you have all of the child actors get an introducing credit. Primarily the one that's important to me is Sarah Steele. I love Sarah Steele. Her work on something like The Good Wife, Into the Good Fight, she's fantastic, and I really love what she has on display in this film as Bernie. Like
she's awesome.
Depths of that character. Yeah. That moment where she is so elated that her mother bought her clothes, to the moment where she realizes that her mother bought her basically a fucking goal outfit, and it wasn't just out of the goodness of her heart, it was a fucking homework assignment. Yeah. I mean, my heart's breaking right now. It was one of the moments where...
The turnaround when Fleur fixes the clothes for her is just as meaningful in the other direction, right?
Yeah, it's just it plays an interesting footnote in this whole story, that thing that she does with Bernie's clothes.
Yeah.
And the introducing Sarah Steele, but the big one, the one that's most important, is introducing Paz Vega, because this is her first like true cinematic role in America.
Yeah.
To the fact that the woman portraying Fleur doesn't speak English at the time that this movie is being made. And James L. Brooks has to have a translator on set with him to be able to communicate with her.
Yeah, yeah. I really love her. I'm one of those guys. I'm one of the weirdos that watch the OA. So I've got like a weird like memory of her in that series later on in her career and stuff like that. She's amazing in this movie. Like, and again, the movie is hers, and it's not like the movie should have been hers, but these scenes take away from it. Like, no, like even in the scenes where you're seeing Adam Sandler and Tay Leone interacting in front of her, like it's all eyes on her, because the story in those moments is about how she's being put in these really uncomfortable and impolite at the least of times and at the worst of times, like inappropriate situations that she is finding herself in with this family. Because part of it being that she feels like she's held hostage in a lot of moments. Like this movie, from her perspective, is a fucking horror movie. Like at the end of the day,
I wrote that down.
This movie is a straight up scary ass movie. It's basically Parasite.
Yeah.
Like it is upsetting.
It's Parasite. It's Get Out. It's all of these these situations of. I mean, like the most deliberate line in my synopsis of this film is no choice but compliance.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's so often it is you either do this or you don't have this job anymore.
And it's just another way to make Tay Leone just into just the worst human on earth in this film, because of the fact that she is often the one wielding that power over Fleur in this movie. Yeah.
And wielding that power with such a sickly sweet, but I'm on your side.
Yes. It is upsetting. Yeah.
What do you got for?
And I think it's purposeful.
It's definitely deliberate.
I don't think Tay Leone is failing in any way. I think she is doing exactly what she needs to make this character come across. It's just a terrible character. Okay, so my old is, I said motivated Sandler for my new. I mean, old is just man-child Sandler, because as much as he is motivated in this movie, it doesn't change the fact that at the end of the day, he's stunted in his growth somewhere along the line. We're just not given we're not privy to the knowledge of what has stunted him in this particular way. But his inability to like discuss anything about his wants and feelings with his wife are like hugely important to a lot of the conflict in this movie, and never discussed or parsed out in any way, but it is present there and it's hard to ignore. So I think specifically the moment where I realized, oh, he's just like, this is just a baby throwing a fit, is the fight at the end when they're supposed to be having this discussion, and like Tay Leone, who is of course in this moment Deborah, is who's going to come out looking just the fucking worst, because this movie never doesn't let her not come out as the worst, is definitely in the low ground in this fight, where she's talking about how she has been with this other guy for 11 weeks. It's a weird number to pull out of her ass, but there's this idea that there is this time period in which she has been seeing somebody else. She wants to be honest with him. She wants to have a fight. She wants to get open with their feelings and all of this stuff. And he is doing this weird bit, and it's not a bit because it's written for him, but like this idea where he's just like not listening, half listening, telling her to slow down. All I could think of is the fucking the stupid Charlie and the Chocolate Factory remake with Johnny Depp there, where he keeps telling the kid to stop mumbling. And I'm just like I can't not think of that whilst watching him talk about how she's talking too fast when she's not. Like, she's clearly not. He's not processing and not paying attention. And there's these elements where I'm supposed to be thinking, like, you know, is he is he having a breakdown? Is there actually something going on where he's not processing this information? But then the ways in which he like gets snarky in moments, it's like, oh no, you're processing just fine. You're just being an asshole. So it's like one of the few moments where he lets kind of like some shitty side of him come out. But the movie has done such a good job at that point of putting Deborah on such a low level to him that it doesn't feel like he's being that bad of a person compared to everything that this woman has done since moment one. So like, it's this really weird moment for me, because I'm sitting there thinking, the guy's kind of being shitty about this right now. And when I think about it, he's never really had to deal with conflict. And if this is the way that he deals with the only conflict I've ever seen him in, this guy's kind of just a kid. Like, he's just a baby. Like, it kind of gives you a real glimpse into the fact that he really has not, like, evolved in any way. And it really makes you think back on a lot of the stuff that she's done with her. So, again, is this script so smart that it's showing you in this moment where she should be seen as the worst that he's actually got some very deep-seated issues that are just not addressed? Or is this movie not smart enough to have not shown this earlier?
Yeah, it's it really, because it sort of came across to me as like he's just so stunned. It's like he's in shock that like he's not processing it. Yeah. But when you put it in terms of what you're saying, his inability to be kind of a grown-up, right? And that's what made him attractive to Deborah in so many ways, is that he's just going to be there for her and he's just supportive. There's that moment where Evelyn confronts her and is like, you're going to lose your husband. And you don't realize how good you have it because you don't realize how good a guy he is. But what makes him a good guy is that he's not developed to the point where he would be angry or malicious in these moments.
Yeah, it's weird because what it basically is implying is that if he had matured in some way, he would have rotted. Right. And that just somehow, like, men either stay boys or they rot. And it's even worse when it's juxtaposed against the fact that, like, all of this is done up against these scenes with Flora and Chum, the dog. Where basically you really start to realize that like what John is he's basically just a big old puppy.
He's just
dog.
Another dog, yeah.
And people say that like it's a cute thing and like you should be into that, but you don't think about the fact that what that means is that at some point, you know, at some point shit's gonna hit the fan and that dog's gonna need to growl. And if he can't growl, he's no good as a dog. Like there's this idea of being like he just like he needs to, he doesn't have any fire in his belly, and we put that in a weird pedestal in our society. So like, I don't want to point that out as like a flaw about him, but it is something that's just, again, just not addressed. So it's not like it's some part of him, some piece of him that I feel like even needs to be fixed. It's just that if we had seen these pieces of him throughout, we'd have a better understanding of why somebody like Deborah is in the position she is with him. And we just don't get that. We just never are given that ability to look into that side of his character.
Yeah, it's, thank you for that. You really just restructured his whole character for me in not a great way, to be completely honest,
I mean,
but a necessary
and again,
way.
This is my old, like, this is leaning into something that Sandler has done with characters in the past. It's just the difference is that you know from moment one that Billy is a man-child. You know from moment one that Nikki is a man-child. It's just in this movie, it takes a while for it to rear its ugly head, but when it does, you suddenly look back on the whole thing, and you think of, like, yeah, that moment when he just decided to just put his hand in her blouse and just grab her, or in her robe and just grab her breasts when they were trying to have a serious conversation. Like, yeah, that's exactly what a 17-year-old boy would do to just end the fight because he wants to get out of it. Like, he's uncomfortable. Like, it's such a weird thing. Like, and it makes you really kind of think back on the whole character in not a great way, but it's too late because at that point you're so deep in the movie and so invested in this woman's the worst that, like, you don't think of it in the moment.
You just made a very compelling argument that's going to make me reassess my entire thought of this film. I don't think it's going to end poorly. I don't think it's going to ultimately change it. But it's very interesting that as that stunted man-child, John Klasky is perhaps the first Adam Sandler character that we haven't seen grow in the movie. Because, like you say, we see Billy as that man-child in the beginning. But at the end, he has a goal. I'm going to go to school and I'm going to become a teacher to try to help the other Billy Madisons that are out there from falling through the cracks. Yeah. Happy Gilmore, right? Like, he understands that, like, I can care about something other than hockey, and I can be, and just because I'm good at something or because I want something doesn't mean that that's what my life has to be. Bobby right. Boucher going to school, little Nicky realizing that he doesn't need to be evil just because he's the son of the devil. Like, all of these man-children characters that we've seen Adam Sandler play, they have arcs, they have growth, but John Klasky does not.
Yeah.
And the fact that he does not is so core to his character that if he were to grow or change in any way, it would ultimately destroy the entire fantasia of a film like Spanglish.
The last thing that I will say on this is that I'm even further than you in that exact conversation, in that it's not just for me that he doesn't grow up throughout this movie, it's that he actually de-ages. Like, he degrades. By the end of this movie, he does not look as good as he did at the beginning of this movie. I can't tell if this movie wants me to feel that way or not. There are moments where I wonder if that's the point, but then there are moments where I think, no, it couldn't be. So, like, the movie's just not clear in that sense.
Yeah, it's oof. Thank you, Sijin. I appreciate that. Two more other olds, right, which I think can contribute to why people ultimately are upset at this movie, because they thought it was going to be an Adam Sandler movie like the other ones that they have seen. Mm-hmm. High-quality H2O is weirdly represented in multiple scenes where he goes to a water cooler to get a glass of water. And also it is the dance at a family function and the hand moving down to the butt where I'm just like, hey, it's kind of like the wedding singer.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird, like, offhand references to Sandler at this point.
But there is a big where there would have been an old if this were an Adam Sandler film. And as Sijin has posited, this is not an Adam Sandler film. It would have been Peter Dante and Alan Covert who offered to buy Flora a drink at that right. at that fancy
the
restaurant.
Two weirdos at the restaurant.
It would have been Jamie and James Roswell. And I don't know Jamie's last name, but he's been in a bunch of other stuff. He's an actor. But, like, it would have been people from that cast of Adam Sandler characters. Actually, it probably would have been Peter Dante and John Loughran, who are the ones who offer it.
John Lovitz.
John Lovitz. I think John Lovitz is a little too big for it.
I don't know, man. It has a lot of the same hints.
I think that, weirdly, John Lovitz would have been Mike, the realtor.
Nice. Yeah.
Because I could see him totally, like, mesmerizing Tia Leone with his ability to make her hair blow back in the Corvette. And suddenly not the convertible. And then suddenly she sees him as this magical thing. And all we see is Ladies Night John fucking Lovitz. But then Pietro, the sous chef, would have probably been Alan Covert. Because that moment in the freezer would have worked so much better. And Rob Schmeigel would have been the maitre d'.
There you go.
Like, it's like, that's what I did with this movie. And the fact that I had to do all that, well, it's very telling, I think, for our ultimate goal here. Which brings us to Borrowed, and I'll let you go first, because as it dictates, it should be your turn to go first.
So the Borrowed concepts in this, I always like to dive kind of into some old Hollywood tropey favorites. And this movie is, it's really hard to ignore the mother-daughter conversations that are all over this movie. It's very Steel Magnolias. It's, you know, there's a whole history of Hollywood dealing with mother-daughter conversations. And the problem is that it leans into too many of the easy tropes, you know, the alcoholic mother or the promiscuous mother somehow gave birth to the over calculated, like the over agended child, right? And that's what you see between Cloris Leachman and Tia Leone there, Evelyn and Deborah, right?
Those are their names.
Right, but then you also have the mother that can't seem to see the, like, suffering she's imparting on her daughter, which you get between Tia Leone and the kid there. Like, there's a lot of mother daughter conversations, not to mention Flora and Christina, like, being the main story of this, right? So there's too much of that to go around to ignore that. Now, the one thing I will say is that as this is the kind of the first movie that we've really seen where Sandler's not really in the creative seat in any way, like, not even like, oh, this was a script we bought and we punched up, like, he's literally just not in the driver's seat for this movie. It doesn't it doesn't ring of Sandler loves old movies, and so here's a reference to an old movie. It rings of here's an old white dude that's been working in Hollywood for 30 years, and this is how he thinks all women talk to each other. And guess what? that's what it is. So as much as I think that that trope is probably the one thing I could point to as like the most old Hollywood of this whole movie, it doesn't in any way come from Sandler. And I don't think there's anything that Sandler's doing in this movie that does come from anywhere old Hollywood, because he's just not given the opportunity to.
I think there's some stuff in this film that comes from new Hollywood. And by new Hollywood, I mean specifically the 80s.
Okay.
And I have two. And the one that is big to me, and the one that I said I'm going to read first, and that's my one, and I have a backup, is the painting behind them at Adam Sandler's restaurant when Floor and John share that night of the conversation of her life, as it's described, is the painting that Cameron Frye gets hyper existential with at the Chicago Museum of Art.
Oh, right. The pointillism one, right?
Yeah.
Sunday in the
Munches,
Park, right?
Yeah. I think it's Munch, right? Edward, I don't know. Yeah.
It's George. It's Monet. It's Sunday in the Park with George, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's that. It's that photo, which is really interesting when you think about the fact that he is this stunted sort of character, very similar and in line with Cameron Frye. And again, at the end of the day, you know that it's not Adam Sandler, but because Adam Sandler's there, and because you know how what he injects into films, it just sort of triggered those same moments in my mind.
Yeah,
the fact
that,
like, that's the thing that's on display at his restaurant. That's the thing that he can see from the kitchen as he looks out on it, is this photo and what it represents in cinema since 1986.
The entire idea of let's not act like John Hughes like broke the code on that painting. People were talking about the idea of pointillism as the sum, the bits equaling the sum and making the sum greater and all of this other crap. But the idea being that, like, from the distance at which he can see that painting from the kitchen, it just looks like a painting of the park. It's not until you get close enough that you realize that that entire painting is done with individual little dots. And, like, that's the bit in Ferris Bueller, is Cameron having that moment of realization as he stares deeper and deeper and deeper into the picture and realizing that it's all just made up of just tiny little atoms and dots, and that's what makes that entire picture come to life. And it is a weird pull for that moment, for that part of his restaurant, because of that exact, like, idea of being like, he likes this kind of high art stuff, but he makes it a point to put it so far away from him that he can't really experience it, which is just a whole other level of something that, again, is it on purpose in this movie? I don't know.
I mean, it feels like it was a choice to put up that specific photo.
Yeah.
But then you also need to think about the fact that there's a couch underneath it. So you're never meant to get close enough to really see what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
It represents just how guarded he himself is. And then it's wonderful mise-en-scene. But as somebody who's seen Ferris Bueller as many times as I have, it's just, that's the idea that it evoked in me, was that moment where Cameron had that realization and just everything about it.
Yeah.
The other one, and this is stupid, I know that it's stupid, but there's this wonderfully subtle moment in Ghostbusters from 1984 where they've just busted Slimer, called in the movie Onion Head, and the guy in charge of the hotel is asking them how much he owes, and Egon just, like, quietly signs to Peter how much they should ask for. And Cloris Leachman, rest in peace, right? Because we lost her last year. Wonderful actor. Cloris Leachman, I could talk about her forever. Where she embodies Harold Ramis so truly and purely during the interview where Deb asks Floor how much she thinks she's worth each week, and she just signs out $650 in this, like, it's so wonderful. And knowing that it's not Adam Sandler, right? Because if it were Adam Sandler, I would say immediately that's what inspires this.
Yeah, right.
But it's not. It's just, it's a joke that was in Hollywood. I mean, so much so that the reason why Egon does it is because it's existed before even that moment in everything. But it's just, that's what my mind went to, was this subtle communication right in front of the person who is so obsessed with themselves that they don't understand what's going on around them.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man.
And that's a weird
story. I mean, like, Evelyn's relationship with Flora in this movie is straight up charming. And honestly, I wish it was more of the film, was her with this older woman that was at a weird place in this world as well, in that she, like, did once fit in and no longer feels she does. It's why she drinks so much. It's why she just sits around and sings her old songs and all this, versus this other woman who feels like she doesn't fit in yet. Like, that's that relationship was just so charming to me, and so well acted between the two of those actresses.
I mean, but at the same thing, going along with everything that you've been talking about, with just how poorly women are treated in this film, is pretty heavily implied that Evelyn prefers John to her own daughter.
Uh-huh.
Like,
oh, yeah.
So much 100%. So the, like, when Flora walks in and she has the glass of port and she's like, I'm going to leave you two alone. I don't care if you cheat on my daughter, John.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because this one's better. And I'm pretty sure you'll still have a place for me in your life. Because you're a nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then, like, the ways in which John treats her as basically his own mother. I mean, there's just the way that she is part of the family is just... Cloris Leachman in this movie, and that character in this movie is, I mean, to be honest, it's part of James Earl Brooks' best kind of writing, like, in general. Like, we talked before about what we know him for, and the idea of, like, the aging star in this, like, as good as it gets, like, really touches on this kind of stuff too, right? Like, I don't know, it's just... It is the role. I almost believe that he wrote that role with her in mind, right? And it feels like that every step of the way because of how well she embodies it.
Oh, yeah. And especially considering James L. Brooks definitely worked with her as far back as the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Right.
So it definitely makes sense that it would be there. Also, mothers and daughters, terms of endearment, if I just want to be a real asshole.
Yeah, no.
Borrowing from his own work.
Yeah, no, this idea, though, that mother-daughter relationships are on display all over this movie, and that is such an, and it's not in a interesting way. Like,
yeah.
It's such a trope way, like every trope about women growing up and dealing with the fact that they've been grown up, and let's put the grandmother in to give us a third perspective and all that sort of stuff is very script writing 101. Applied to a female lens, which is interesting, but not far enough, especially not in 2004.
It's also crazy when you think of it as script writing 101, but it's script writing 101 because James L. Brooks was the one writing the scripts like that.
And that's true. I mean, you want to talk about script writing 101, he is one of those people that would have developed that class for sure.
Yeah, like he definitely would have. Yeah. And you think about something like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, where it is Mary and it is Rhoda and it is Betty White and Cloris Leachman, and how they all represent different types of women in different points in their life.
Yeah.
Like, it's just mothers and daughters, but without the blood relationship. Like,
but the thing is like, you look at somebody else that I would put up in that echelon as somebody like a Nora Ephron or something, right? Mm-hmm. And like, and her evolution of writing women has been awesome to watch. Now, you know, I think she's at a bit of an advantage there. I don't want to say that it's part and parcel because she is a woman, but I mean, like, I'm sure that there's a huge element of self-exploration that goes into that, but that's not fair to her or to James L. Brooks, because like, he should be capable of growing up with his writing as well, and she should not be expected to remain stunted. Like, right? Like, there's like, so I'm just pointing out that a writer of that caliber of that era, like, was able to do just fine evolving and writing more and more interesting women in her career, and he just doesn't seem to be elevating himself much in the 7-year stint between this and As Good As It Gets.
Yeah. Oof. Or even the 20 years between Terms of Endearment.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
This.
Yeah.
Oof. All right, which brings us to Blue. And I'm going to go first, and I think I'm starting to finally understand what you're talking about, because I'm going to say the Booga Booga Sweater.
Oh, okay. okay.
Because the fuck is that about? That you got to say it's a good Booga Booga, and just everybody at the table looking like, the fuck is she talking about? And I'm like, that's good, because I'm sitting here going, the fuck is she talking about? Like, I know that it's like mojo or just like it's kismet.
Who uses the term first?
What? The booga booga? Who do you think?
Yeah.
Deborah. It's
yeah.
Deborah. Anything yeah. where you're just like, why did that just happen?
Yeah.
Generally comes out of the mouth of Deborah Klasky.
It's that idea of being that, like, again, I can't tell if the movie is smarter than me or not in this moment, but it's introducing this idea that on top of everything, this poor woman that has to deal with learning the English language is that English especially is notorious for just doing whatever the fuck it wants, mm-hmm. person to person. Like region to region, state to state, like side of the country to side of the country, sure. But even human to human, like the ways in which we interact with our moms are different than the ways we interact with our dads, are different than the ways we interact with our dogs. So like anybody that wanted to learn English from me, don't pay attention when I'm talking about dogs, because that's not good English that I'm using then, right? like that's not the time to pay attention to me, right? But that idea of being that the English language is that kind of broken already, and then adding to that the element that she is trying to like learn it on the fly as she's got this job and all these other stressors, like it, and so it's meant to, it feels like it is a moment that is meant to highlight that conversation, right, about language, going back to the idea that like they want to name this movie Spanglish and they want to talk about where that comes from and why that's you know.
Yeah,
but the fact of the matter is that they don't go that route with that conversation. They all just, she just ends up looking like a fucking weirdo.
Yeah, it's I don't even it's just, but it's what I had to highlight, because there's a lot of blue in this movie, but that is the first time where I'm like, oh yeah, they are wearing the same sweater. That's a little interesting, because I don't know where Flor would have gotten the same sweater that she's wearing. And I guess it's sort of revealed where like she goes to the outlets when she goes to buy the clothes for Bernie. Mm-hmm. But I just, the fact that like it's blue and the booga booga of it all, it's like, this is a moment in this film, and it follows the other moment of Monica walking into the door and us seeing a blue mug full of at least $1,000.
Yeah, that was just all 20s just shoved in there.
And it feels like that's going to end up being a plot point, but it's not.
It never. Yeah.
It just happens. I don't know. But yeah, I'm going to go with the booga booga sweaters and everything that they represent in Spanglish. Yeah.
I mean, mine's already kind of blown. We've talked about it a bunch, but like I believe this movie is sexist. And the moment for me, and the big moment for me out of everything in this movie that may or may not come across as offensive, the most offensive scene I think in this movie is that moment when they're trying to have a conversation and John doesn't know how to end it, and he literally out of nowhere slips his hand into her robe. I literally just like out loud was just like, whoa, like what is that? And like, she calls him out on it, and there's a moment where the movie has that conversation, but from everything that I know about that woman up to that point and everything I learn about her after, sure doesn't look like she's going to be the one that I'm supposed to believe is right in that moment. Like, I don't know. It's really weird, because like it comes out of nowhere. It seems to make me want me to believe that he's being fun in that scene, and it's okay. It's just fun. And I'm just like, no, it's gross, inappropriate. Like, it's the same thing. Like when people say like, you know, she's my wife. Like I can't possibly sexually assault her. No, like consent is still a thing amongst consenting couples. Consent is an ongoing conversation. It is not a one and done deal. And just because she said I do does not mean that you get to just do whatever you want to her body, bro. And like, that is everything that happens in that second when he does it. And she says something about it, and you want to applaud it, but then you can't be on her side for like 90% of the other conversation. So you're just like, I really want to defend this moment, but you're really kind of making this hard for me, woman. And like, the movie shouldn't make you feel that way. That's gross. That's a gross feeling for me to have.
Calling her woman isn't great, Seijin.
That's what the movie
but
is. That's
what the
I'm
movie
saying.
Is doing. I know.
The
I understand.
Me to do.
The like, way. That I, no. I'm just being a jerk. I'm just calling you out on what the film does, and just like, don't let it affect you, Seijin. You're better than this.
I know. It's such a weird. Like the movie puts you in just such a weird position with the way in which you're supposed to understand and this character. And I don't understand why. Like, what is gained by making this woman the center of this, of all of these conflicts, and just never seeming to land on her feet, even by the end of the movie, Because again, because it's not their movie, there's not really a resolution, on their story.
I had to write. We don't know what happens with them. We just know that Flor never saw John again, based on what we've read in this, in what we've seen in the letter. And maybe they're together, maybe they're not. And honestly, I don't know if I care. I mean, they're probably still together. Like, if I had to extrapolate from everything that happened, John, being the person that he is and just, like, averting from conflict, is probably just going to go back to his position as her husband.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I can't even bring myself to start thinking about that, because then I start getting depressed about how, like, people don't change and nobody ever grows up. Like, so, like, I don't even want to, like, it'll leave a bad taste in your mouth if you think too hard about that part of the story, and that sucks.
And they don't want you to. I mean, that's the other thing. Yeah, is that Jim Zell Brooks, this may have just been a story about the Klaskys and their life and everything, and then the end of the movie is, oh, so where do we go from here? And there's no way to go from it to end this movie, whereas an audience member, you feel okay with what happened. So why don't we refocus and frame this whole event through the eyes of their housekeeper?
Yeah.
Like, because it just feels like that's what they're doing. I honestly don't know is what I have to say there.
I don't know, man. I don't have too much else to say on this movie, but you sounded like you had some stuff.
I have a couple of things that I feel need to be touched on in this film. And using blue as a leaping off point, there's a full-on sex scene in this movie, right, Seijin?
There is. Yeah, yeah. There is.
Uncomfortable.
I mean, yeah. I mean, purposely so. Like it's not like, oh, they filmed it barely or anything. Like I don't know why choices were made, but they were clearly asked to make choices. Yeah, it's very weird. And again, just the weird ways in which she clearly has some deep-seated issues that need to be looked at, because that sex scene ends with her breaking down in tears, not because of anything wrong with the sex, but because of her own personal baggage that she's bringing to it, which is, like, just not explored, not talked about, not conversed about. And like I said, there's never any indication that, like, she's seeking to, like, change any of that about her. Like, well, quite the opposite. We get the impression from the way that John reacts to her in that moment that this is something that happens frequently, and he has, like, a system to help. Like, the words that he's using, it doesn't sound like those are the first time he's had to say those words.
Yeah, please don't cry. Please don't cry.
I mean, yeah.
Oh,
right.
No,
well, not
no.
just that, but like, yeah, but like, you did so well or something. Like, there's, yeah, like, there's other lines, like, in it.
A
where
lot
it's
of
like,
coping.
You're happy. You're having a good time.
You enjoyed, like, it. You.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it makes it even grosser, because when you, like, yeah, it's just weird.
It feels like it comes from nowhere. And I mean, it's the first, like, sex scene that we've seen in any of these movies that we've explored, right? Like,
full on, yeah.
Yeah, it just, I mean, you don't see anything. It's still a PG-13 film, but I was not expecting it. And I don't know how to feel about that, but I just wasn't expecting it at all.
I'll tell you, the weird roller coaster that I went on with it is, like, I maybe this says more about my psyche than anything else, but I was just like, oh, this is going to be a threshold moment for them, because this happens because she has read the review, the 4-star review. She runs home screaming, I read it, I'm so excited, and then, like, jumps him, and like, and they finally have sex, and there's this implication that this is not a thing that happens often much anymore in their relationship. And so, like, they're both, like, super into it, and it's going well, and then all of a sudden it's not. And so, like, as a viewer, like, I was led to believe, like, oh, this is going to be the thing that, like, things are going to start changing for them. They're going to start making strides and changes in their relationship and making effort. And it's like, oh, no, this is also part of their old pattern. We hadn't been privy to it yet. So, like, it feels like it's almost misleading at first because of how sudden in your face it is for them to then turn it around and then completely 180 on you again and make it horrible is just, like, really upsetting of a ride.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. And I don't know. But I feel it's worth noting that this is the first time in an Adam Sandler cinematic universe that we have what looks like a full-on sex scene featuring, yep, Adam Sandler. I don't know if that's going to be significant going forward. If this opens a door and now we can't shut it, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. But it's something worth discussing. The other thing that I'd like to talk about, I mean, quick. It is the New York Times that comes to review his restaurant, right? Because there's
that's
that whole
impression I got.
Because the maitre d' says they must have flown them out special to review the restaurant. And it's just so odd that they have multiple copies of the New York Times. It's odd that Bernie reads it and then he's like, you did so good there. And it's like, I haven't been led to any issue that this girl has any issue reading. Like, where did that come from?
No, see, I think that was him being snarky. And you can't tell because of how charming he is. But I think that was him being snarky. Like she's reading this whole thing about how good he's done. And he's just ignoring that and encouraging his daughter. It's like it's a snarky, charming, good dad move more than anything. I that's how I read it. I couldn't tell you. Again, movie's not clear.
Issue there is, like, we see that she puts herself this all the strain on her to excel in school. So then I'm like, oh, so in addition to everything else, the girl has issues reading? Like, what the hell, movie? Yeah,
this poor girl.
And also she has a brother who did something. And then Flora's goodbye to him is, you're good. Be good, Georgie. And it's like, what was that in relationship to?
I don't care that you ate the class hamster, Georgie. You're still good.
You're a good boy. Be a good boy. Be you. Eat the hamster. It's very, like, that whole thing is something. But I would like to explore the fact that there's also a new hire at the restaurant who also seems to be an undocumented Mexican immigrant, Alex.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he's there for two scenes in the restaurant, but then also he is the one who drives Flor and Christina to Malibu. And it's like, do they know each other? Or was it just, oh, here's another person from your area who happens to have a truck. He can obviously help you move in with us.
Yeah.
It just reeks of, everybody knows each other, right? That's just how the community works. And
just a scene or two earlier, right? Where Deborah, like, grabs the first random person on the street to, like,
with no confirmation that that guy speaks Spanish,
right?
Like, it's that whole thing, and the fact that his name is just Manuel is, that's like meta levels.
Yeah.
That, like, makes me think that this movie is smarter than I'm giving it credit for, but it can't be. But that whole thing where, like, even there, where he sees Flor and in his first name, I gotta put a shirt on, I need to be presentable. And, like, by all accounts, that guy, for that one scene, I mean, it's his last acting performance, which is a weird bit of trivia on IMDb, because I'm like, did something happen? What happened with this guy? Who was this guy beforehand? That IMDb says that as of, like, 2017, this is his last on-screen performance.
That's one of the trivia pieces, like, about Spanglish, right?
I was like, okay, what happened here? Because he's so good in it, and the empathy for Flor's situation, that whole, I see that you're in a bad situation, I don't know how to help you in this moment, and I'm sorry for that.
Yeah.
Like, Evelyn has just so much on display where she's like, she didn't even know she had a daughter, and now you just expect her to move her in with us? She's clearly a very private person. And then, like, no, I need her. And we haven't seen how Flor has made herself so invaluable to the family.
No. Yeah,
like,
no.
The only moment we see is sort of where she undermines Deborah in taking those clothes that created the fracture between Deb and Bernie and altered them so that they would fit her. Like, I don't, what has she done where, like, she needs her? I need her.
The dependence on Flora going with them down to Malibu is bizarre to me. It's wild.
Yeah, it's all in sake of the plot.
Yeah.
And then I don't, And I just want to talk about what is my one of my favorite things while they're down at Malibu, which is the whole sea glass challenge.
Yeah.
Of like, yeah, no, you don't give a highly motivated kid the prospect of money. Because let me tell you, if it were me and I was offered that, I'd be looking for sea glass. I'm doing it anyway. And now there's a cash reward. And then also the whole, I mean, the greatest scene in this movie, which is when Christina and Floor are having the conversation with John about don't be giving my daughter money.
Yeah.
Like, just the acting on display in that, and what Shelby Bruce is doing, and Paz Vega, and Adam Sandler, they are one person in that moment, while also still being three distinct voices, and it is a masterclass on just, like, kinetic freaking conversation in a movie, and it's wonderful, and it's kind of sad that it's, like, mired in the middle of Spanglish.
Yeah, yeah. In what is arguably the most padded out unnecessary part of this movie, because I will point out as we hit the close to 2 hour mark with this recording, the idea being that this movie is over 2 hours long and it does not need to be. There is no reason. There are, like you talked earlier about how Georgie's probably got scenes that were dropped on the floor. And I say, like, good riddance to him. I could have used more of that in this movie. Like, I just don't. Why did we go to Malibu?
But because the whole the main, like,
it's to introduce the daughter to the family. That
it's to introduce the daughter to the family, because then that becomes the main driving plot of the film. Is Deborah, like, finally finding a girl who's around the same age as her daughter who appreciates the meddling that she's doing.
Right.
And it's and that becomes the whole thing, because Flora doesn't quit her job because of her attraction to John, which, like, we haven't even really talked to the fact that, like, she falls head over heels for John because of the fact, like, her attraction to him seems to be purely emotional and mental, while his is basically just you're fucking hot.
Yeah, yeah, like, exactly. It's, he provides for her everything that she has needed for, but she has been striving for safety and in a male figure that, you know, someone she can trust and love and all of this stuff. And she sees that in him and she falls for him. And it's what leads to her falling for him. And all we are given from him, as our first scene implied, is that he's just like, I mean, you know, look at you. It's just like, thanks, guy. Thanks, bud.
Yeah, it's because I wrote it in my notes. I'm like, she is purely attracted to him on a mental level. And that's wonderful. It's not something that you generally see in these sort of things. It's also kind of crazy considering how shallow he kind of is emotionally.
Yes. Yeah.
But really, she just empathizes with the fact that he's overwhelmed and that he can't seem to make any strides for his own life. And that's how she feels. Like, it's just shared trauma between them. Yeah. And, I mean, I respect the fuck out of this movie for the fact that the only thing they do is kind of grade school kiss each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if they slept together, this movie, I would launch it to the sun forever. Because it would cross a line in terms of the character of Flora and who she is and what she stands for.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you clarified that it's in terms of her because at least it would have made John interesting.
Right, exactly. No, it's all about Floor. Fact that, like, Floor doesn't really get in this movie. That's Floor's movie and her story. She has so little of it.
Yeah.
Even though we see wonderful moments on display, like Paz Vega brings so much life and energy to this character who pretty much just exists to be a witness to the death of a marriage.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, oof. All right. So I guess we got to have the discussion. Is this an Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe movie?
I mean, I'm going to give it a cold no.
Yeah, it's a no. I mean, that's why I said this could be the shortest episode ever. And yet it's still almost 2 hours long. Because the answer is no. It's not an Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe movie. You don't have any of the players from any of... Honestly, if Alan Colvert showed up in this movie, it'd be a conversation that I would be willing to have.
Yeah, but if you had gotten one modicum of any hint of Adam Sandler getting to do his thing where he gets to you know, bring a couple of friends along for the ride, bring some creative juice to the whole project. And I'm not saying he even needed to or should have been or anything of that. But if he had, it'd be a different conversation right now. But it's just, it's so divorced from anything that Sandler does of his own work. And, like, it's cool that he gets to do work like this. And I'm excited to see if we find any more like this, because it's actually kind of rare to see him taking such a backseat to other creatives. But yeah, this one is just, is purely just him showing up for the ride.
Yeah. Adam Sandler is a soldier in this film, and he does what his general asks of him, and really not much else.
Yeah.
And he does it well, but it's missing that spark of Adam Sandler that would make this an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film. I will say this, though. I will say this. We could have used this as an Adam and, because Drew Barrymore shows up brief in the background of a scene. And I have to feel like that's the movie they're watching as a nod to the fact that Adam Sandler was in a movie with Drew Barrymore this same year.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, like, I think this movie leads a lot to some stuff that you see later down the line, both for comedy in general and for Sandler in general. It's going to be hard to ignore this movie when we then watch Funny People eventually, because, like watching him on screen at a Judd Apatow film and notably getting more creative control, and the ways in which you can see a lot more of him on display in that movie, even though, again, I don't even really think it's his movie. It's really more about Seth Rogen, and, you know, Sandler definitely has much more of a role in that movie than he does in this one. But we'll talk about that when we come to it. But you can definitely see that kind of stuff on display there. I half joked about, like, the length of this film being also a huge factor as well, but also just, like, structure and stuff. Like, the idea being that there are moments where there are some real lows in this movie for people, and that's only in service of the joke coming later to kind of raise you back up, and it does not work here. But I am really curious if this movie had come out years later. The other thing I wondered about this movie, because we have now officially said that we don't think it's an Adam Sandler cinematic universe movie, is, did it have to be Adam Sandler? I started looking at what else was kind of going on around at this time, and, like, 2004 is, like, the year that both Frasier and Friends ended. Like, imagine this movie with somebody from one of the cast members in those ended up in this instead, because, like, you know, not unusual, like, when your long-running series ends, you give a shot at film. Like, imagine if this role had been something that, like,
Matt
you
LeBlanc.
Saw Matthew Perry in,
if
or
I
Matt
could see
LeBlanc.
Matt LeBlanc in this role.
Like, David Schwimmer. David Schwimmer in this role. Like straight up. You know, you joke all you want. Or I was thinking more about, like, some of the side actors that had long-running roles on the show, but, like, so they weren't even on the show even for the last couple of seasons, but, like a Paul Rudd from Friends, like, showing up.
Well,
in this
Paul
movie.
Rudd eventually shows up with James L. Brooks in How Do You Know?
Yeah, Owen Wilson, right? Or something like that?
With Owen Wilson and Reese Witherspoon 6 years down the line from this movie. Which is interesting because Reese Witherspoon, again, Little Nicky. So, like, there's some weird overlap in that stuff, in the people that could have been. Yeah, it's strange that it's Adam Sandler. And honestly, that's sort of why my big question was, how does this get made? And it's more the fact, like, how does this script... It's not just
Sandler's
how
hands.
Does this... Yeah, like, why does James L. Brooks say, you know who I think would be great for this is Adam Sandler?
I mean, it's got to be Punch Drunk Love at that point, right?
Yeah.
It's got to be this idea that he is hot off of doing that, and so his agent is able to put a lot more stuff in front of him that is not necessarily his own stuff. And he just goes down the line, and I mean, like, you're not going to deny when a James L. Brooks script, after his last movie was As Good As It Gets, and it was 7 years ago or 5 years ago, whenever it gets to you, like, you don't turn that one away right away. You read it, and, like, I can totally see how on the page this role, this character would feel like, hey, yeah, like let's do it. Like, this is something out of the ordinary for me. It's working with the director I don't know. I don't have to do any heavy lifting besides showing up on set. Like, I don't have to do any of the producing side of things, or let's do it. So, like, I get why he says yes, and I kind of get why it's in front of him. The answer is really, really honestly Punch Drunk Love. As much as I said earlier I was going to try and sever all ties between the two, that is the one moment where I think that movie really plays into him being in this movie. Not because of what he was doing in that movie, but the fact that there's just enough buzz around him that people throw everything at him, essentially, for the next couple of years.
I could also see the Jack Nicholson connection, the fact that they do the
anger management.
Anger management. and, you know, Jack Nicholson was in As Good As It Gets. So if James L. Brooks is talking to other people, like, you worked with him in Anger Management, do you think he could do this role? Oh, yeah, he's an actor. He's an actor. You can't handle the truth, how good he's an actor. I don't think that's how Jack Nicholson talks in real life, but it's the kind of joke that they would do on The Critic, which is related to James L. Brooks.
Well, and you know, the other thing to remember about a guy like that, too, is, and James L. Brooks, too, is this cannot be the first time that they've run into Sandler, right?
Exactly.
Like, so, like that idea being, like he was working on SNL for throughout the 90s, and James L. Brooks was working on all sorts of movies and stuff, but he was also working on things like The Simpsons and sitcoms and stuff. So they must have ended up in the same room at some parties. They must have known each other in some capacity. It wasn't like Sandler was like the new hot shit that nobody had ever heard of.
So it's one of those situations where if you're Adam Sandler and James L. Brooks says, you want to read for this, and then you get offered it, yeah, why wouldn't I take it? We're saying right now it's not an ASCU film, but I think it has an important effect on the ASCU on an almost meta-textual level in the fact that 2004 is that first year where we really kind of see a duality of Adam Sandler, where he does the movie that is very involved in terms of the production side and the script writing side and everything with something like 50 First Dates. And then he also goes and does sort of the prestige picture that might get him noticed by other people with something like Spanglish.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the first time that we see that happen. And it's sort of the first year that it could happen in a lot of ways.
Well, I think this year is the year that burns him out, because this is also the year that Longest Yard comes out. And he's also producing
Longest Yard is 2005.
Yeah, that's true.
It's the next year.
It's the next year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't wait to talk about the old on that one. But we'll get there.
He's just kind of in that working nonstop thing up until this moment when suddenly he starts to kind of do the break movie where this is going to be the movie I maybe don't have to put so much effort into. And at the time, that means I'm going to go to other creatives that are working and work on their movies. Nowadays, it seems more like I'm just going to shit one out. But it does lend itself to the start of a pattern for him in terms of work, where you can tell the year that he's putting the work in and you can tell the year when he's not.
Yeah. And it's because I think he burned himself out in 2004.
Yeah.
And we've looked at both of the movies and look at what is on display in something like 50 First Dates and something like Spanglish. Honestly, with all respect to the man, neither one of them are a particularly great performance by him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, like, that's not saying something. I think that he really brings a lot to the character of John Klasky, but I think John Klasky is the one he focuses on more as opposed to Henry Roth in 50 First Dates.
And yeah, which one pays off?
Yeah, exactly. So what lesson do you learn from that, right? You develop this role, and that's the movie that nobody really cares about, and then you kind of half-ass and just sort of ride on the laurels of the fact that it's me and Drew Barrymore again, and that movie goes on to be kind of their most successful. Mm-hmm. But again, I think that lack of love in 2004 is why ultimately both of these films do not end up with a place in our version of an Adam Sandler cinematic universe, which is something to think about. Anything you'd like to say, Season, before we send this one off and away?
Yeah, goodbye and so long. I don't know if I'll ever watch you again, Spanglish.
Yes, goodbye.
Maybe on a train.
Maybe on a plane. It seems to be the exclusive place where people have watched Spanglish. Because when I asked Will, his response was, I watched it on a plane once.
Yeah.
So there's where it goes. I guess announcement time, just so you can prepare for the next episode, is That's My Boy. Because we're going to stick with the villainous Sandlers of it all.
So, truly villainous Sandlers. All right.
Perhaps we'll see. So the next one is That's My Boy. If you've enjoyed Seijin and I doing the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, a more focused look at a topic, you might enjoy it where we talk about everything. On our other podcast, The Say Report, new episodes of that drop every Monday, and that can be found wherever you're going to be listening to podcasts. This has been the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. We're here every month. It's a monthly joint, and thank you very much for joining us. Seijin, anything else to say before we send this one away?
No, man. Make sure that you hit Dev and I up on Twitter if you have any questions about the show. You can find me at Siege vs. the World.
Right, and I'm available at Devin D. Decker. But until next time, just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good night, folks.
Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.